The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamfrone. I'm a licensed naturopathic physician and professor and lecturer at the University of Bridgeport and herbalist. And usually Dr. Kamai is on with us or alternating, but she's on break. So we'll be doing the show today and talking about issues in health, wellness, and alternative medicine today. We have a special guest, Dr. Sally Ward. She has a Master of Public Health, and she's a medical doctor with the One Medical Group in San Francisco, which emphasizes integrative medicine, lifestyle modifications, and disease prevention. She's an accomplished physician leader with a passion for improving medicine and trying to educate people about alternative medicine. She has a residency from Dartmouth, and that's where she got her MPH, Master's in Public Health. So we're going to ask her a little bit of interesting questions about what really is public health and what we can be doing holistically maybe to help the public, and also is certified by the American Board of Family Medicine and Preventive Medicine. Dr. Ward, are you there?
Hi, Dr. Z.
Good to hear from you.
Yeah, good to talk to you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm really interested in talking to more and more doctors who are, kind of becoming holistic and interested in that training. You know, I started out as being holistic. That's why I sought out, being a naturopathic doctor. But, a lot of doctors, they decide to go into mainstream medicine, and then they sort of become very interested in alternative medicine. So tell us a little bit about your growth in this field and how you got interested in it and where you are now.
Well, I started out really interested in integrative medicine and public health, and also primary care, and took the coursework to. Be and wound up taking the more conventional route, mm-hmm. Although I did do quite a bit of integrative stuff along the way. Okay. So I wound up going into medical school and realizing that it was one approach, it wasn't the only approach, and then ended up going into family medicine residency, which I found to be one of the more open fields, one of the more open specialties in medicine. And And then also wanted to incorporate the public health piece of it, as well as quality improvement. So that's where I introduced the preventive medicine residency that included the Master of Public Health. So what I've done for myself when I chose to not shoot the same route that you did, I was really looking for a practice where I could be in an integrated group where we had practitioners of all types. And so what I've done is I work for a group called One Medical Group, and we're a national member-supported patient-centered primary care practice, and we have multiple offices in San Francisco and New York, and we'll be expanding to Washington, D.C. this fall. And we do things a little bit differently. We offer same-day appointments that start on time, and we offer longer visits so we can build relationships with our patients, and we're designed to be extremely convenient for patients. We streamline things by using technology, so we have online appointment scheduling and email access to all of our providers, and we have an iPhone app that can help people diagnose common illnesses and renew their medications and things like that.
Well, here's a question. Now, how could you be integrated? Like, is your model where many practitioners are actually seeing the one patient and then deciding the proper route, or is it just that there's integrated people under the same roof? What's really your...
It's a little of both.
Okay, good.
To be honest, we have, so of our providers, and we call them providers because it's a real mix. We have MDs, DOs, naturopathic doctors, so NDs like you.
Mm-hmm.
We have acupuncturists, and we have nutritionists.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have a nurse running an anxiety management program as well. And we've also offered some programs, lifestyle management kind of stuff. So it's quite a range. So of the conventional folks, I would say the DOs and the MDs, there's a range of people who really practice only allopathic medicine, and then those who have had full training and are board certified in integrative medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have naturopathic doctors and acupuncturists. And so we work in various combinations.
So how do you know when it's right for them to see a patient? I mean, say you have a patient in front of you, and you really think that they would benefit from acupuncture, or maybe you wouldn't think. Who makes those decisions and makes the referral? Do you confer after? Do you all meet the patient and then decide which is the best route? How does that actually work?
Oh, we just all work as primary care providers, and have the conversation with the patient, and when we're in the process of listening to them and helping learning what's going on with them, diagnosing their issue, and then coming up with a treatment plan, we then decide what that might look like. And sometimes that includes acupuncture. Sometimes that could include homeopathy. Sometimes that could include EFT. Sometimes it could include really looking at seeing a naturopath to look a lot at digestion using that paradigm.
Great. That's what I like to hear, is that there's kind of a more roundtable discussion and trying to figure out what would the patient respond to best, and how, you know, it's not like a turf war, like, well, I think that, the patient would do this better, but that there's open discussion and that the physicians seem to be open to referring to each other and trying things out and seeing how the patient will respond to the various modalities and philosophies under one roof. And that's, I think, really great. What are patients looking these for? I mean, you know, you're in this particular primary care-based system and whatnot, with a specialty in your particular field. Are patients looking for that from their provider? I mean, when they go to their allopathic or mainstream kind of doc, I mean, sometimes, I know in my small community, I get a lot of referrals from other docs, but at the same time, they kind of on the surface level kind of know a little bit about holistic and integrated medicine, and they know enough to that they don't know enough to really treat someone and they refer them to me. But a lot of patients are directly asking people for alternative care, and there's not naturopaths or other acupuncturists all over the place. So it's kind of a conundrum for many docs.
It's definitely a wide spectrum. I think we have patients of all kinds. So some patients come in only want a naturopathic doctor, and some only want an allopathic doctor. And it's, you just have to meet them where they are, and that's what I do. So I will refer to the naturopath or anybody else in the practice if needed, but really there's such a wide range. I mean, there's really a wide range.
Sure.
We see patients of all types.
Right. And we see that you're seeing any trends in illness and what people are kind of coming in for more than ever?
Oh, sure. Probably the same things you're seeing. a lot of stress. Are you seeing a lot of stress-related illness, a lot of sleep problems, a lot of digestive issues, pain from not sleeping well, people having foggy minds, they call it foggy brain, headaches. I think people are sort of suffering from always being plugged in now that we have smartphones and email access all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that stress is a huge, and people have to know the signs and symptoms of when they are stressed. That, you know, they maybe their blood pressure, you know, you might work up their kidneys and check their rein in and aldosterone, see if they're retaining too much salt and water and things like that. They don't have any blockages anywhere, but really it's all about their perception of life, and they feel like they're constantly being bombarded. And in that case, their main intervention really would be to figure out how can you impact their life such that they either learn the skills of self-responsibility and stress management, even learning how to breathe, sending them to the yoga therapist to learn meditation, or, you know what I'm saying? Maybe at that point a medication will just be palliative, but you have to continue. You just can't stop at the, oh, you'll be on this antihypertensive for life. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I personally always have, I think most people in primary care have the lifestyle modification discussion with people when it comes to stress, different providers to different degrees and different practices. But always, I tend to practice in a way that I really don't encourage medication unless it's strongly needed or unless somebody's having a lot of difficulty with motivation to change. And then I might introduce a concept of medication as an alternative to protect their heart in the case of hypertension until they can actually see some change in their lives. So it's interesting that some people are very motivated to make change and never, ever want to take a medication, and they'll do anything in their power to stay off of that medication. And they'll start a daily meditation practice or do guided imagery every day or go to therapy or increase their exercise regimen or change their diet or change their relationships. It's incredible. And
well, you're actually acting as a teacher in a way, you know,
mm-hmm,
like you're asking people what's the person's level of knowledge regarding their health and personal health. You know, do they know that they have really control over these things, or do they hand over all control of health to their doctor and don't do anything in between? Or do they recognize that their signs and symptoms are indications of their level of health, and then asking them sort of what type of medicine or sphere of health or skills do they have which would either on the physical, mental, or spiritual level help them? So these are all things that I see that patients are some people aren't aware, that they don't know that their blood pressure, well, you know, that's why they call it the silent killer. They might not even know their blood pressure. They might just get a splitting headache every time they're, you know, done with work, and they don't realize that maybe they're dehydrated or their blood pressure is very high. So I think our doctor as teacher, or docere as they say in Latin, is extremely important part of holistic medicine.
I agree. I think eliciting somebody's values and helping them understand where they are and what they're capable of, and really engaging each person in shared decision-making so that we're both part of the discussion. I mean, the person in the office who we're calling the patient knows himself or herself better than anybody else does. And so, and really, the best decisions are going to lie within that person. It's incredible how many people, even when trying that technique and having that discussion, will still say, I mean, look, that. Are some people who still always want to fall back on the medication and say, no, that I'm not going to make any changes. Let's just start with the medication. And some
people
say,
but, you know, as you know, I mean, that is important, and I guess they need to, I'm glad that you're not stopping there. You're saying, well, you know, it is important. You don't want to get a stroke, so we want your blood pressure to be low, but we don't want you to stop there. We want you to try to understand that the choices that you're making, whether what you think, what you eat, your lack of doing exercise, or your choice of eating a particular food or way is causing this. So it's trying to make people more responsible for the results that they're getting. You reap what you sow, as they say.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yep.
Talk about, now I know you have a master's in public health, and we And I know a big part of that is understanding prevention and trends and health. And I you know, there's a very interesting dilemma in medicine. I'll give you an example. For instance, like with breast cancer, a lot of people think that getting a mammogram all the time is really preventive medicine. But in, I know in naturopathic medicine, we really consider that more early detection versus true prevention. And certainly a more preventative thing would find out if you have the various genes that may trigger cancer, or understanding how well your liver metabolizes estrogen, or whether you have whether you're a woman that's making the more toxic types of estrogens versus the least toxic types of estrogens, because not all estrogens the same, it turns out. And then I had one preventive medicine doctor said something really funny on my other radio show. He said, which is very quotable. He says, if every restaurant changed the salt and pepper shakers to garlic powder and turmeric, we would see a drop in people's blood pressure and their health. I thought that was kind of funny, but that really is kind of true prevention in a way.
It is. It is. I know. If we could, I mean, some food companies are actually decreasing the amount of salt that they're putting in their products, and I think that's where we will probably see real change, because throughout the country, people really do, as much as we, right, end up eating a lot of processed food.
Absolutely.
And, I mean, that's what lines the shelves of our grocery stores, and not everybody is great at shopping the perimeter of the grocery store, as we always like to advise. So I think if we could, I think a true public health intervention would be getting these companies to actually bring down the amounts of salt in their foods and other things that might be harmful. It was successful with trans fats.
Yeah, you're right, and that's a nice trend. I don't know if that was fueled by the people in the public health sector.
Policy,
But that's kind of that would be a really interesting way to go. You know, simple things that we could do. Simple suggestions for manufacturers to do that wouldn't cost them money, because that's the bottom line. Like Dr. Noel was saying in his show before, the corporations, the bottom line is money, and if it's not going to cost them any more money, if we could teach them a way to save money and make the food cheaper, yet at the same time it's going to be healthier, that would be sort of an important revelation in these people. So tell me about, we're seeing that there's certain trends of people being overtreated for, like, prostate cancer and things like that. How is that driving up the healthcare costs in the country, and what would be a more preventive medicine way to deal with these things?
That's a good question. Driving up healthcare costs, the very high costs of healthcare come from procedures, mostly. I mean, it's all of it. It's too much medicine where it's not warranted. So what happens with prostate cancer is we have a not-so-great screening test, arguably a useless screening test. And
like the PSA you're talking
about. The PSA test, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so the PSA has lots of false positives, lots of false negatives, and if it goes above a certain number, depending on your age, it might end up warranting some biopsies. And what ends up happening is a lot of people end up having biopsies and other big procedures, and sometimes actually removal of the prostate, when they might not have actually died from that disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, have the PCA3? That's available. It's kind of more of it's a urine test. I know we do it here in the clinic, where after the man gets a more vigorous digital rectal exam, we then collect the urine, send it to the lab, and it can actually, some of those cancer cells give off that PCA3 marker or antigen, and then that can be very instrumental in seeing who needs a biopsy versus who doesn't. You familiar with that, doctor?
Interesting. No, it has not made it into the primary care realm.
Yeah, well, look that up. Google that.
The PCA3.
PCA3. Okay. Yeah, this is a very important test that
Oh, it would be great. I mean, we need an alternative.
Yeah, this is. I mean, this may be it. I'm not sure. If you look online, there's a lot of interesting scientific articles in the urology. See, I teach urology at the University of Bridgeport, so I'm kind of, you know.
Oh, okay.
On that level, I'm sort of trying to stay up ahead of the curve. But yeah, so this is something that may be important. But what about screening men for high estrogen levels, for instance? This is something that I've been doing for years now, where I've been checking a man's estrogen level when they hit 40s, and you see them starting to get a pot belly and muscle mass and syndrome X type of symptomology, and then I check their estrogen, because the more fat the guy has on him, the higher the estrogen. And there's some pretty good research that it's not just dihydrotestosterone and other types of things that may instigate prostate cancer, but it may actually be estrogens that are potentially part of the whole process.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So we've been screening people for, besides the DHT levels and other things like that. We also, of course, know a lot about zinc and looking at zinc levels, and I'm interested in my study here at the University of Bridgeport. We're screening men with prostate cancer for cadmium levels using red blood cell membrane levels of cadmium, and also looking at urine and hair and nail samples and things like that, and are finding we haven't published it yet, but it might be coming out sooner than later, correlation with some of these metals in the body that are kind of act as somewhat, I guess, cancer promoters or genetic disruptor type of thing. So we have some of my graduates that are working at the Cancer Treatment Centers of America that are doing that type of work. But, I think that's kind of, I don't know what your feeling are about, public health, but those are some of the things that people, I think, we should be looking at for public health. What do you think as far as the trends of public health that would be helpful to prevent so much more disease?
Well, to prevent disease, I mean, I think so much of the disease that we have is related to stress and being overweight. Mm. And what's interesting is that when people come in, they might have multiple diagnoses, all the same thing, which is therapeutic lifestyle change, changing the way they eat, changing their activity levels, increasing their exercise, decreasing their stress. So I think anything that the public health system can do to help people with any of those efforts would be welcome. So how
do you change people's eating habits? What are some things that you've found in your own practice that seems to motivate people? Some people have different ways of being. I mean, most people, they have such time poverty that it's so convenient to just throw something in the microwave and nuke it. and who knows what that's doing. I'd love to see some long-term study. I mean, we've had microwaves for now, 30 years or so? So we got to be doing something in the someone should be doing their MPH on the effect of microwaving food and see if it makes any real difference. I mean, I my gut feeling is, I don't even have a microwave, so that's how I feel about it, but my gut feeling is it's probably not going to be the greatest thing, but that's convenience. Like you said, shopping on in the frozen section versus the fresh food and vegetable section.
Mm-hmm.
How do you motivate people?
How do you motivate people? I mean, I really just try to better understand, much like when I'm talking smoker, just truly, really try to understand why they're doing what they're doing, what do they get out of it, and then try to come up with a good substitute. And I do two other things. One is usually trying to meet them where they often want to make a change, and so then help them uncover what that change to make and what they think might be reasonable. And that could be, okay, I'm going to.
You know what? It sounds like maybe you're on. Are you on a cell phone, Dr. Moore?
I'm not.
No, huh? We're having a lot of problems with the phone. But anyway, I'm looking at the time. It's time to take a quick break.
Okay.
About halfway, and maybe the engineers can work on your connection. Sometimes you're kind of coming in and out there, but I'm not sure.
Okay.
But nonetheless, we'd like you to stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network, and This is the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z Show. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperl. Stay with us as we keep talking about the principles of holistic medicine and with Dr. Ward. And we're back with more of the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we have Dr. Ward of the OneMedical.com. This is the website, by the way, www.OneMedical.com. And we're talking about, you know, principles in alternative and integrative medicine and public health and primary care, and talking about, you know, sort of trends and how we could certainly improve the health of America. So we're really excited to have her on and talk about these principles. You know, a lot of times people have, you know, they have to understand the principles of the healing process, and we call that the therapeutic order or the hierarchy of healing. And you know, sometimes they certainly can't, if they have really degenerative disease, ulcers, tumors, atrophy, they really need, like you said, they need surgery or strong medicines to certainly remove the pathology and address the pathology, pharmacological or synthetic. But there's a lot of times that people are in this kind of whole flux, because, you know, disease is a process, and they could be benefited from understanding alternative therapies and things like acupuncture. And I know you wanted to talk a little bit about when acupuncture would be particularly beneficial. And I know you in your practice, you have you refer people to. Are you actually the acupuncturist, or you have a person on staff that does that?
I'm not. We have a few of our physicians are trained in acupuncture, but we also have three acupuncturists who.
So somebody, you have people that are trained in,
yes,
in like basic acupuncture, but some people that really have a thorough background in Oriental pathology and,
yes,
traditional,
mm-hmm,
Chinese medicine. Yeah, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. So. When do you generally, I'm sure you've seen lots of benefits from that, sending people to the acupuncture side of things.
I have, and I also have been doing acupuncture as a patient myself for years, so I'm a big believer in acupuncture and Chinese medicine. But I think the main tenets of acupuncture are really to support the immune system. So there are so many different reasons to do that. I know it's interesting that insurance companies will often pay for acupuncture or provide an acupuncture benefit for people if they're being treated for pain specifically, and that's just one,
right,
one of many reasons why,
like, medicine,
you might want to use it.
It seems like medicine is just kind of myopic in thinking that,
mm-hmm,
you know, kind of like the understanding the old gate theory, endorphins, and not understanding that, you know, acupuncture can help decrease or slow down the aging process, increase circulation to certain areas, move what the Chinese concept of qi is, move energy, increase hormones. I've actually seen mm-hmm, MRI changes when people get acupuncture. So,
mm-hmm,
that's,
so
yeah,
I
it's
would,
extremely
yeah,
important.
Mood, energy, irregular cycles,
mm-hmm,
any sort of hormonal imbalances.
Well,
those are all reasons to refer. Actually, acupuncturists can often help cure a cold, or at,
sure,
least speed it along.
Have you seen, switching gears, more and more women with, you know, terrible menopauses? I know, I don't know if you see more women than men in your practice. I generally do. I think it's a trend that women probably are more attuned to their bodies in many cases, and that's why I see mostly women in my practice. You know, I'd say 80% are women, and only 20% are guys. Why is that? I mean, you're have a degree in public health. What do you think that's going on there?
We definitely don't see that kind of disparity, but we do know that women go to the doctor more often than men do.
Yeah.
But it's nothing like an 80-20 split.
Yeah, wow.
But And then when the
I
men
think guys
sometimes,
wait till it's broke and then come.
Or they wait
sick.
Till the women in their lives tell them they have to go.
Exactly, and that's true. Many times it's the husband or spouse or significant other dragging the person in, kicking and screaming. And then, of course, once they're in, then they sort of open up and talk about. And a lot of times, believe it or not, it's you know, things like erectile dysfunction and other types of cardiac episodes and things like that that brings the guy in. It's not really maintenance. It's kind of crisis management at that time.
Exactly.
So they're not doing any. So your job is to try to teach them about, you know, do they have any concerns of their health and what are they at risk for? What systems are the weakest? I love getting a guy in my practice because then I run, you know, different tests and whatnot and try to explain to them what they can do to live healthier, what choices they have. So are there any markers that you do when you run lab work on patients that you're really interested in looking at as far as how well they're going to do as they age? Are there any, preventive medicine markers in the blood work that you want to make sure that you're looking at constantly?
Well, not so much. I'm just trying to think of any.
Well, I was thinking more like I know you in some of your questions that you sent, you talked about, you know, like chronic disease. So we're seeing a lot of diabetes. So we want we want to make sure we're monitoring a person's hemoglobin A1C constantly or something like that. So
well, we tend to go by. I mean, we tend to look at evidence and recommendations. Yes, we do screen diabetes at certain ages or given certain risk factors, and we don't do it every 6 months who's low risk. We do it every few years after a certain age. If somebody has a certain risk factor or two certain risk factors, we do it more frequently. Similarly, everybody should have their blood pressure checked every year at least. Similarly, everybody should have. And we're generally
I couldn't make that out. I think you dropped out. Your phone's dropping out. What did you say before?
Well, everybody should have their blood pressure tested at least once a year, and then obviously we test for cholesterol. But we do it in a stratified way. I mean, it's not the same testing for everybody. Really, it's what's a person's health history, what's a person's family history, how old are they, and do they need certain tests? I mean, it's a little more personalized based on evidence-based guidelines for the most part. There's an art in there as well, obviously, because evidence and guidelines don't apply to everybody, every situation.
Right.
So we really have to take it case by case.
Yeah, so you look at the what the patient's history is, family history, and you may say, well, maybe it's a good idea to do this, that. What do you think about the whole cholesterol thing and so many people on Lipitor and things like that? Don't you think that people, do you think it's diet that's the cause of all the elevated cholesterol, or maybe when the LDLs are up, they're not taking enough antioxidants and things like that? I don't really know your training in that, but I'd like your opinion on it. It's kind of
With cholesterol, you're right. I think a lot of people, I think what you're getting at anyway, is at least what I see, is a lot of people on cholesterol-lowering medications who have so much room for improvement in other realms of their lives.
Exactly.
So if they lost weight and they ate differently and they exercised, they very, very likely would lower their cholesterol and improve their good cholesterol.
Elevated cholesterol has become almost like this lab entity.
Mm-hmm.
Has almost taken on a persona of itself as being like a, get this number down and do it even synthetically, without, I like your approach with teaching people, like what are they doing in their life that's raising these numbers? Why is your LDL up? Well, that's a sign of oxidated cholesterol. Well, why is there so much oxidation happening in the body? Well, maybe that has to do with they're not eating enough, antioxidant-rich vegetables or having things that have a high ORAC value, and then that gets into further teaching them about, you know, maybe what they should be eating and what they shouldn't be eating, not, you know, fried food that has epoxide trans fatty acids. So, yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at, how you know, your approach is looking at, you know, teaching people new ways, new models of disease. Patients have a vision, but maybe someone's not satisfied with their level of health, and maybe they're not connected to their body and symptomology, or they don't know that disease is a message sometimes for the person to wake up and smell, you know, wake up and change. And so if you give somebody Lipitor, which is lowering their cholesterol, yeah, you may be doing some good, but you're doing them a disservice in a way, because you're not making them responsible for how they got to be like that way. Anyway, that's my philosophy, is to try to get patients involved in their healing as an active participant. What's your feelings on that?
I think so many people don't have any idea. I mean, they just don't know. They realize, because the American way is sort of too much and next little, and they don't really know.
Your phone's dropping out again. Can you repeat what you said before?
Yeah, I said a lot of times I don't think people realize that they do have room for improvement. They don't realize that they're eating too much or they're exercising too little, and they really need to be told that these are options. And I just had that conversation with my father last week as he was going in for a heart, and he was telling him about a plant-based food diet and considering making changes before agreeing to any more testing, certainly if they were going to decide to put in a stent or something like that. And he was floored. No idea. He had no idea that these dietary options were out there. Well, he said that. We probably talked about some before, there are people who are surprised over and over again. I mean, I see it all the time. Oh, I could try this or I could try that. And I think it's a matter of telling people they want to be on the medication and assuming that that's the only way to treat.
So you're saying it's education. I'm happy to say my dad's 80 almost, and he's on no medications whatsoever.
Oh,
he takes
so
ginseng
great.
And he takes resveratrol and a lot of antioxidants. I mean, it's amazing. Works hard, has a good philosophy in life, is happy, certainly seems like understands that illness is more than the absence of symptoms, or health is more than the absence of symptoms. It's, you know, kind of like the way you look at it in life. And I think that's important, is to understand where do people have those health essentials: air, water, food, exercise, love, support, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's treating the whole person, isn't it? Isn't that looking at mental, physical, and emotional aspects of their health besides, you know, the genetic and the kind of the evidence-based type of stuff? I mean,
sure.
There's a lot to that. We're just not functioning in a placebo-controlled study. We're real people. We have emotional things. Some of us harbor anger, and I'm sure that affects our lives, resentment and greed and things. Do you have a counseling in your center and people that can talk to people about how they become what they think about, and that plays a big role in their health care?
We do. Well, I think a lot of us talk to our patients about that, all to different degrees, and we all have different belief systems and ways of talking to patients about that. But I think most patients will have that conversation with their providers. We have the only behavioral health piece we have under in our practice right now is an anxiety management program.
So tell us a little bit about, I think a lot more, many people are anxious. They certainly, you can see by the amount of, they're worried about just everything. I think they listen to the news too much, but
it's fear.
But they worry about everything, and you know, worry is kind of, unfortunately, it's fear that's misplaced in a way, and it's kind of reviewing things in your mind that don't even, well, maybe they do exist, and they should be a little concerned about it, but they kind of blow that maybe out of proportion in a way. So you, I guess you're seeing, if you have a practitioner involved in that, you're seeing a lot of anxiety out there.
Yes. Definitely see a lot of anxiety, and I think a lot of it's stress-related and circumstantial and some of the stuff we were talking about earlier. That's problems.
I didn't hear you, Doctor, your phone again, unfortunately.
Anxiety, I think, itself is anxiety and sleep problems, probably most, and digestive problems. I think those are probably the three big leaders of stress manifestation.
So sleep is a major issue. So
mm-hmm.
when someone comes in and they're not sleeping, I guess many different illnesses can manifest as a result of just not getting a good enough sleep.
That's right.
So do you have any suggestions for people out there listening? If they don't have good sleep, is there just practical things? Like I tell people, make sure your alarm clock isn't shining in your face. Like, you know, some people keep it 6 inches away from their eyes, and that light somehow interacts with their pineal and kind of suppresses their melatonin. And plus, who knows the electromagnetic, if the
mm-hmm.
electromagnetic things. I know they did a, years ago, way, I remember when I was in college in the late 70s, right, they did a study where they put magnets around homing pigeons. Now, homing pigeons use melatonin and their pineal gland as the main way that they're able to home and get back to wherever they need to do. So they hung magnets around their head, and they totally lost their sense of direction. None of them can home. So they showed in animal models that electromagnetic forces can affect the pineal gland. Well, if you have a clock radio plugged in real close to your head, or you're sleeping under an electric blanket like that, maybe it's impacting you. And plus the light shining in your eyes maybe impacts the melatonin. So I tell people, you know, move the alarm clock across the room. It makes you get up anyway to turn it off if it goes on instead of keep hitting snooze. You won't be late for work. But these are some practical things, you know, sleep hygiene, noise levels in the room, proper temperature, besides, you know, getting into the pharmacologics of looking at, you know, their neurotransmitters and all these other things like that, because sleep is more complicated than just neurotransmitters.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right, but a lot of people don't even know about good sleep hygiene when you go through it with them. Oh, there's a great idea to actually move the clock, to actually make sure that the room is dark, to get electronics out of the room, to not have screen time a couple of hours before sleep.
Well, that's a good point, like not watch the news and not watch things that are very agitating or going to make them think about their... I mean, it seems like when people have insomnia... I ask people, what's going on? Well, they say, well, there's different types of insomnia. Some people can't fall asleep. Some people can't stay asleep. And then some people wake up in the morning and it's if they didn't sleep. So I tell people, well, yeah, that's actually the three types of insomnia, sleep onset, sleep duration, and sleep offset. They're all different types of insomnia. They mean different things with the endocrine system and the adrenals and every, you know, get into the whole holistic thing. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. But nonetheless, you know, I teach people about these different types of insomnia, and, you know, sometimes it's hormones that need to be balanced, or maybe in a man, it's their prostate's acting up, and they're, you know, having to get up to urinate. So if you can handle that, you help them sleep. Women, I'm sure you've seen a lot of women going through menopause that have, you know, hot flashes at night, and it's their alterations in their hormones that's causing their insomnia problems. And if you can help them balance their life and hormones and stress, they seem to get a better sleep. But there's some people, it seems like some of the elderly, they tend to have this chronic insomnia that's very difficult to treat.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had a lot of success even naturopathically or homeopathically with some patients, and they just have to go on Ativan and things like that, and that's fine, because in that case maybe the alternative, maybe they're too far gone. Remember, like I mentioned before, there's this therapeutic order, and at some level, if the weakened or damaged systems are so damaged and abnormal, they need those medications because they're in this chronic degenerative part of the whole spectrum of health and disease as a whole spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So.
Yep.
Well, it was great to have you on.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about, again, your website and how, if patients are interested in choosing a holistic practice.
You can find us at the website you mentioned before, www.onemedical.com, and one is spelled out as a word, so it's onemedical.com. And you can access all three of our New York, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. there, see a list of all of our practitioners of all different kinds, register to become a patient, see different people's philosophies, schedule appointments, and everything right there at the website.
Have you guys written any articles, or is there stuff on the web, your website?
We do, actually. If you go to the website, there's actually a link to a blog.
Nice.
And there's we have HealthWrite, we're writing and putting stuff up each day, and you can follow us on Facebook.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yep.
Nice to have you on, Dr. Ward. And
thanks so much, Dr. Ward.
Good work in alternative medicine and helping your patients, because that's basically what it's all about. If we can, we may not be, we believe that the patient's the doctor, really, or the
exactly. The patient's the expert, that's for sure.
Yeah. We're just kind of, we can be a good path in their direction.
That's right.
All right.
Well, thanks so much, and thanks so much to the National Nurse and Progressive Radio Network.
Great. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Hope you learned something, at least in our nice conversation about alternative medicine. And again, stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network for wonderful programs that sort of help stimulate your thinking process. That's what it's all about. Take care, folks, and have a great day. Bye-bye.